I'm going to try teaching this from down here this morning, which means either I'm going to look around to see what's showing up on the screen. Yeah, I think I'm turned on here. Yeah, I got a green light here, so I did my part. I've pushed the button. Okay. Either I'm going to look around occasionally to see what's showing back there. I've got an outline here of the same thing in Portuguese. I'll try to speak English using this. And actually, the title I gave this in Portuguese is God Speaks to His Children About Sex. And that's really what we're going to look at this morning. We're going to look at what God has to say to us as His children about this topic. And I think it's something that we do need to recognize is dealt with in the Scriptures, and therefore we need to deal with it in much the same way. We live in a society where we are constantly bombarded by sexual messages. We see that in all kinds of things, whether it's by suggestions, by advertising, and it's things we can't completely rid ourselves of or free ourselves from. Driving down this road, walking down the street, we are going to be subjected to those things. Many Christians, parents, have difficulty still in dealing with that, even in teaching their own children. How do we approach these kinds of subjects with our own children? There are some extremes that I believe we need to avoid in this. We need to avoid an approach that treats sex as something that is dirty or evil. Some people treating it even as if it were the original sin. We also need to avoid the other extreme of that, as treating it as something that's insignificant, as if it were just some biological process that is a part of our physical nature and has nothing else to do. There is a very serious spiritual side to this that we need to be looking at. So as Christians, I think we ought to have the most balanced perspective of sex of anybody in the world, because we have the instructions given to us by our Creator to help us understand where this fits into our service to Him and how we ought to approach it. And that's what we're going to be looking at this morning, is to see this from a biblical perspective. And what I want to do on this is basically go through the Bible. Now, the outline that I'm using was already sent out to, I think, everybody in the congregation here. If you didn't get that, you can ask Jared or somebody to make sure that gets forwarded on to you. There are going to be a number of passages that I'm going to refer to without reading, just because of the time that we have. If we had an hour and a half or 2 hours on this, I'd go through and read all these verses, and we'd open it up for more discussion than we'll have time for this morning. But I'm going to cite some passages, and we'll read some of those, because I think it's important for us to make sure that we are working from a biblical basis in everything that we're going to have to say. So we need to start at the beginning. We need to go all the way back to Genesis, because that's where the subject begins. In Genesis chapter 1, verses 27 and 28, on the sixth day of creation, it says, "So God created man in His own image. In the image of God He created him. Male and female He created them. Then God blessed them, and God said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, and over every living thing that moves on the earth.'" So at the very point of creation, God introduced the concept of the sexual relationship between husband and wife. Chapter 2 gives us an expanded view of what happened on that part of the sixth day. And in chapter 2, there's some comments that he makes about it, where we see in verse 18 that he created the woman, verse 18, verse 22, verse 23, that he created and gave them responsibility to man. And in that context, we understand very clearly God created the woman for the man. There's no doubt about that, reading through Genesis chapter 2. And he said then in verse 24, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." That's the basic principle that God established. And in verse 25, we find husband and wife in paradise. And I think I'm forgetting to hit the button here. Husband and wife in paradise. As he says there, they were both naked, the man and his wife, and were not ashamed. So we can recognize in this an innocence about that relationship between them. What I would describe as a discovery. It's interesting that God doesn't relate to us here, doesn't communicate to us here or anywhere else in the Bible any kind of real specific description of what goes on. He basically says they were together. Husband and wife were together. And I think the idea of an innocence coming into that discovery in marriage and what would be a normal, natural relationship. But one of the things that I want us to make sure we understand very clearly, all of this is in the first two chapters of Genesis, before sin. There's nothing sinful about this. There's nothing dirty about what we're seeing here. This is something good, pure, that God made. It was a part of that creation described at the end of chapter 1 when he said, he looked at the whole thing and said it was very good. That includes the relationship that God designed of a physical relationship between a husband and wife. But chapter 3, things got messed up. Eve listened to that snake and things started to go awry from that point. And so we then have to start looking at sex as it is presented for us after the sin in the Garden of Eden. And we're going to continue now looking at some things about that. What is it that changed as we look here in chapter 3, verse 7, when we see the sin that takes place? That the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. So now there's some things that are different because they have disobeyed God and have eaten of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Now there is, in the place of that innocence, there is now the ability to distinguish between good and evil. There's the ability to feel shame that wasn't there before. And now they feel a necessity for clothing. And so they make some clothing. I think we can pretty well understand. They probably covered up the things that were the most different. And so there's some sort of clothing that's being made because they recognize now a sense of shame that didn't exist before. And what we're seeing here is the kind of transition that we observe that happens as little children grow up. You know, little kids don't feel that sense of shame about showing their bodies to other people. I remember one time when I won't say which of my daughters, because if this ever gets back to one of them, they won't know which one's being embarrassed. But one of my daughters was a little kid. We lived in Cincinnati, Ohio, and I had gotten some sand delivered out in front of the house for a project I was working on. And it was just by the sidewalk. And there's the front yard and the sidewalk and then the street. It was an old neighborhood we lived in. And my wife was working in the kitchen one day, and she looked out the window, and she saw our daughter playing out there in the sand. She was probably a couple of years old, maybe three, playing in that sand pile out right there by the sidewalk, right there by the street, completely naked. Well, we know that kind of thing happens with little kids. But then they grow up and they learn that there is to be a sense of shame in the sense of not displaying themselves to the world. And so Adam and Eve all of a sudden recognize that they need to cover something up. Now, we're going to understand as we go on through this, the problem is not specifically the fact that they would be... I'm going to stand off here to the side, or I'm not going to watch that. Everybody can hear me okay if I'm over here, right? Okay, that way I can keep an eye on what's going up here, because I'm going to forget to push the button here. The problem is not husband and wife being together naked. We're going to see that clearly as we go on through this, but there's other things involved here. There's already a social aspect of their existence. In verse 8, God walks in the garden. They are, in a sense, living together with other persons present, if you will. We know that future time will bring in children to this. And so they are already now aware of this difference, and they're recognizing the need to cover themselves up. They didn't do a great job of that. Get down to verse 21, and it tells us, "And also for Adam and his wife, the Lord God made tunics of skin and clothed them." And I think there's a couple of different points that are important in that. One is that as soon as sin entered the world, we see the first time that there's an animal that has to die, blood that has to be shed, to cover that sin, to cover the shame that's brought in by that sin. And the other aspect of it is that what God made, the word translated tunics in this version, is the idea of a garment that falls down around the body. It's the idea that it's actually covering the body, not just covering what would be the most intimate or different parts, if you will. And so God is teaching them now something about decency, about privacy, in the way they're going to conduct and dress themselves. Now, let's just take a pause here for a moment. Even after the sin of Adam and Eve, their sin was not sexual in nature. The sin was eating of the tree. So even after this sin, if they had respected, and all those who had come after them, had respected what we see even here in Genesis 3, if it were a perfect world, how would things be even to our time? And I want you to try to imagine that, a world in which people cover themselves, in which people still respect the principle of the creation that God made, a man for a woman. So young people would grow up with practically no notion of the bodies of the opposite sex. A young man would see women around, but covered, clothed. He wouldn't really have much of an idea what was under those loose-fitting clothes that she was wearing. And similarly, a young woman would grow up seeing men with their bodies covered. Marriage would then bring an experience of exclusive discovery of the two. It'd be basically his only contact with a female body and her only contact with a male body. And so what we'd have there would be an incomparable relationship of these two. The standard of beauty would be one's own spouse, because you wouldn't know what other people's husbands or wives really looked like in that kind of an intimate way. The standard of performance, if you will, would be one's experience with that spouse, because there would be no other experience, and that still should be what we're striving for today. There would be no other images or fantasies to create any kind of different expectations. It would be something exclusive and special between one man and one woman, and that's that. Now, wouldn't that be a better world than what we have today? Wouldn't that give us a much better perspective on sex than what we have today in a world where those principles have long since been abandoned and are often ridiculed by the people in this world in which we live? So, while we don't have that world, that perfect world, we have to deal with the challenge of seeking to put sex back in the place where it belongs. And I realize we're not going to be able to change everything around us. We're not going to be able to change the fact that we are going to be exposed to information and images that are not really going to be helpful necessarily to our marriage relationships. But I want us to think about what we as Christians choose to do in relation to this. Conversion means a radical change in thought and behavior. And it's especially interesting in the New Testament epistles that are written to primarily Gentile churches. The comments that are made a number of times about the works of the flesh that you have put off, and now the fruit of the Spirit that you are going to develop. The idea of getting rid of the impurity, and there are often several terms used referring to sexual impurity in those descriptions. This is what you used to do. This is the way you used to behave. This is the way you used to think. But it's not the way you behave or think now. And that's the challenge for us, because we are still bombarded by temptations, but we need to be able to learn to think differently. In addition to the things that are stated in the different epistles about that contrast of the transformation that takes place, we can't forget what Jesus said, even about this question of thoughts, back in Matthew chapter 5. Because he tells us it's more than just a physical action that's involved here. When he said, "You've heard that it was said to them, those of old, you shall not commit adultery," Jesus is not arguing with that statement itself. That's part of the law. You shall not commit adultery. The problem is the way they were treating it. And as he had said a few verses earlier, that your righteousness must exceed the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, it's not just about a legalistic obedience of a single command and saying, you can't touch her, but you can think whatever you want to. Jesus goes on in verse 28 and says, "But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." And so that's a challenge, a big challenge for us in the world in which we live, where there is such free expression and free display of things that are off limits to us. We need to recognize the challenge of maintaining the purity of sex in marriage. And I want to look at a couple of verses here with you. First of all, in Hebrews chapter 13, verse 4. As I suggested at the very beginning, if we start out looking at sex as something dirty, then we're missing the point of what the Scriptures teach. Hebrews 13, verse 4, "Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge." Undefiled, it's pure, it's clean. There's nothing evil or dirty about that relationship in marriage as God has placed it. I want to show you a couple things from the Song of Solomon. I checked this. I didn't check very many versions in English, so somebody may have a version that fits better with what I'd really like to say here. I make this point from the Portuguese Bible that I use, and the words here, it's just translated a little differently maybe in some of the English versions. Song of Solomon basically describes the courtship, as I understand the book anyway. There are different interpretations of it, but I understand that the book basically describes the courtship and the marriage, and then things that happen after the marriage in the relationship of the husband and wife. And as I understand the book, basically, the marriage ceremony takes place in chapter 4, and that then is followed on in the same chapter by what we might think of as the wedding night or the beginning of the honeymoon. And we get it by the time we get to the beginning of chapter 5, now they're coming out and saying, it's all just fine. basically coming out of the chambers, the bed chambers of that night. So everything after chapter 5, verse 1, is they're already married. Verse 2, chapter 5, verse 2, and there's a time lapse between verses 1 and 2. Sometime later, the wife says, "I sleep, but my heart is awake. It is the voice of my beloved. He knocks, saying, 'Open for me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is covered with dew, my locks with the drops of the night.'" And he goes on to talk about how she doesn't immediately open for him, and then he leaves, and then she goes after him. A little bit of tension in the marriage relationship is what it deals with. But the point that I want to get across here is the word that's translated "perfect one" in verse 2. It's a word that means undefiled, morally and ethically pure, or immaculate. In fact, the Portuguese version that I usually use uses the word "imaculada," which is immaculate. It's the same word the Catholics use to talk about Mary. And I agree with them on that point. Mary was immaculate throughout her life. I'm not saying she was a virgin throughout her life. And that's exactly the point I want to make. Chapter 6, verse 9, still within the context now of the couple being married, he says it again, "My dove, my perfect one," is the only one, the only one of her mother. Again, the perfect one there comes from this word that has the idea of being immaculate. And when you start to think about the implications of that in Hebrews 13:4, I think it changes the way we approach the subject of sexual purity. I used to teach that it's important to maintain your sexual purity until marriage. I do not teach that anymore. What I teach now is it is important to maintain your sexual purity your entire life until death. Because when a virgin marries and continues to be faithful, that person never loses purity in that. May no longer be a virgin. She's now a married woman or he's a married man. But purity was not abandoned in this. Continues to be pure. So what I'm saying, men, you look at your wife who has been faithful to you throughout your marriage as your immaculate one, as your undefiled and pure one, and you are going to work to help her continue to be that immaculate one, and vice versa in the relationship of the wife to the husband. That's the ideal. That's what we're striving for. That's what we are trying to get for our children and for ourselves. And so it's not sufficient to say maintain your sexual purity until you get married. You maintain your sexual purity until you die. And after that, it won't matter anymore because there's no more sex. In heaven, it's all over with. There is no marriage. There is none of this in heaven. But the point of this is the purity that is maintained in the marriage relationship. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, it is an exclusive relationship. If there may come some doubt because of the tolerance of polygamy during some periods of the Old Testament, that's clearly removed for us in the New Testament. Because now in 1 Corinthians 7, agreeing with what Jesus taught in Matthew 19, Paul says, "Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman." He'll later define that this is because of the context, a circumstance they were facing. "Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife and let each woman have her own husband." That's a one-to-one relationship, male to female. Each man has his own wife, just one. Each woman has her own husband, just one. "Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does." You've given that to your spouse. You've protected it throughout your life, and now you've given it as a gift to your spouse, and so it is an exclusive relationship between husband and wife. Nobody else is involved in that, and nobody else ever should be involved in that. We need to have a very high opinion of sex because God has a high opinion of us. And if you look in the same book, now going back to the end of chapter 6, just before he talks about this exclusive marriage relationship, he talked about what we're not supposed to do. And that is to involve ourselves in an illicit sexual relationship, a man involved with a prostitute, for example. And so in chapter 6, he concludes that point by saying in verse 18, "Flee sexual immorality. Every sin that a man does is outside the body, but he who commits sexual immorality sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have from God, and you are not your own? For you were bought at a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's." We need to have a high estimate of sex because God values us. He bought us. We are His sanctuary or temple, and we are to protect that. So now let's move on through. And I'm trying to move through this fairly rapidly because our time is limited. But I want us to move on through here and recognize that for God, sex is not a game. It is not a mere biological process or a sporting event. It's something serious. It's a fundamental aspect of marriage. We've looked at that already in Genesis chapter 2. We're going to notice later that sex does not define marriage in and of itself. But it's something so important that it almost identifies marriage. And I want you to kind of hang on that point for a minute. And I'm going to try to develop that with some examples as we work through this. Genesis chapter 24, verse 67. I've heard this verse used sometimes to suggest that if two people have relations, that means they are married. I don't agree with that, and I'll help to show that a little later. But I want us to notice that it is something that's important and emphasized here as basically what is cementing that relationship. Then Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rebekah, and she became his wife, and he loved her. So Isaac was comforted after his mother's death. So that coming together in a relationship of husband and wife is described as almost the way to identify marriage. Paul does something similar with that in 1 Corinthians 6 when he uses the language of Genesis 2, the two shall become one flesh, to say that's why a man should not be joined to a prostitute, because he would be joining his flesh to that woman. And he's not to do that. This is serious business, he's saying. The question of a sexual involvement is serious. It affects things. It changes relationships. In this case, changes relationship with God, because it's taking what belongs to God and handing it over to a prostitute. As God looks at sex in the Old Testament, He treated it very seriously. And I'll go through these fairly quickly, but I think it's important for us to realize, especially in the Law of Moses, just how serious the question of sex was. If a betrothed woman was raped, the penalty under the Law of Moses for the rapist was the death penalty. Serious business. Adultery, death penalty for both. Fornication, required to marry. If a young man humiliated a young lady having sexual relations with her, he would now be required to marry her. It's interesting in this case that he has no option in that case. Now, I'm not saying that's what applies today. I'm using this to illustrate the seriousness of what it was in the Old Testament. But I do want to note one thing that's brought out in that text in Exodus 22. The young man who is guilty of fornication cannot refuse to marry the girl at that point. But her father can say, I'm not going to allow this marriage. That helps us to understand something important. The sex act by itself is not marriage. It is still possible to refuse the marriage. In this case, the father refusing to allow his daughter to marry this man. It helps us understand that point, that sex by itself does not constitute marriage. And so we don't fall into that trap that some people will try to use today. There are a number of other sexual relationships condemned in the Old Testament as worthy of death. Leviticus chapter 20. Now, if sex were just a mere biological function that doesn't mean anything, how could God have treated it this way? The one who created sex, who gave it to us, said, you need to understand where it belongs, and if it's going to be taken outside that context, it will always have very serious consequences. It'll either end life or change life forever for the one who's involved in that. And so it continues throughout the scriptures to have that kind of importance. Still in the Old Testament, a false accusation of impurity. This would be a false accusation brought by a man who said that his wife was not a virgin when she married. If that accusation were proven to be false, he would be punished, would be fined, and would never have the right to divorce her, because he had questioned her purity, her integrity, and had questioned even her own parents' protection of her. The parents proving that she was pure, he would then have no right to divorce, and he would have to pay a fine to the father for having questioned that. If the accusation were true, it was death penalty. This is talking about a young lady who was not a virgin when she married. If that were proven to be true, it would be the death penalty for her. Serious business. Adultery, confirmed by the ritual of using holy water to to prove whether or not the woman had committed adultery. The adulteress, if she were convicted by that, would be cursed. Her health would be debilitated. She would be unable to have children after that. Now, as we move on into the prophets, especially in the books of Ezekiel and Hosea, God uses the marriage relationship as a comparison of his relationship to Israel. The same idea we have in Ephesians 5, for example, of the relationship of Christ and the church. He's the husband, and Israel, or Judah, or both of them, in these Old Testament texts, are treated as the wife. And so in all of those cases, in Ezekiel chapter 16, chapter 23, Hosea, using the very example of Hosea's own marriage to Gomer, in each of these cases, her unfaithfulness, the wife's unfaithfulness, was just cause for God to put her away. And that's brought out in all of these texts that I've cited there. One other thing I want us to take a look at this is in Hosea. In Hosea, as I said, the example is used based on the marriage of Hosea and Gomer. And my understanding is not that Gomer was already impure at the time she married, but that she was a woman that would show that tendency and did fall into adultery afterwards. And so Hosea puts her away for that, as God had put away his people because of their adultery. But now in chapter 3, Hosea chapter 3, says, "Then the Lord said to me, 'Go again, love a woman who is loved by a lover and is committing adultery, just like the love of the Lord for the children of Israel, who looked to other gods and loved the raisin cakes of the pagans.' So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver and 1.5 homers of barley." Now, verse 3, and if you're following in a different version, there may be a variation here in verse 3. There is a textual issue in verse 3. I believe the best evidence we can find supports what is read here in verse 3, especially in the context of what's here. "And I said to her, 'You shall stay with me many days. You shall not play the harlot, nor shall you have a man. So too will I be toward you. For the children of Israel shall abide many days without king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or teraphim. Afterward, the children of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They shall fear the Lord and his goodness in the latter days." The Portuguese version has it almost as if she's coming to him trembling when it talks about fearing the Lord here. And the concept seems to be here that when they come back together, that's completing the reconciliation process after the separation that had occurred, that Hosea is taking her back as his wife again. For a time, it's, you stay there, you're not going to be involved with anybody, I'll wait. But when they come back together, that's what completes this process of reconciliation. Song of Solomon, probably one of the least studied and least taught books of the Bible. I've gotten to where I use it in special studies with couples. I prefer to do it in that context, where it's just groups of husbands and wives, only married people, and we read through the book Song of Solomon, and we go through it, and we talk about what it's saying. And you know, it's not a dirty book. It's not like some of these movies and books that get sold today. It's a very beautiful presentation of a developing love that is then consummated in the marriage relationship and continues even as they face some challenges and difficulties in marriage. It shows the beauty of sex in marriage. It shows it as something that is good and pure. Oops. Tripping over the stairs here is not part of the plan for today. I want to show one other thing, and I think this might be helpful to young people, especially in a dating relationship. A point that's brought out in Genesis chapter 26. You remember those stories about Abraham fibbing about Sarah and Isaac later doing the same thing about his wife and how he got caught in Genesis chapter 26. It's kind of an interesting point that's brought here. Genesis 26 verse 8. "Now it came to pass when he had been there a long time that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah his wife. And Abimelech called Isaac and said, 'Quite obviously she is your wife, so how could you say she is my sister?' Isaac said to him, 'Because I said, lest I die on account of her.'" What I want to notice here, do you think that Isaac was having sexual relations with his wife in some public place that the king would be able to see him? I don't see that. I don't think that's at all the point here. But what he was doing, the affection he was showing to her, something that was not inappropriate to be seen in public doing that, was still something that said, they're married. This is the way husbands and wives behave. It's not the way single people ought to behave. You know, there's some people that have the idea that in a dating relationship, you can do just about anything you want to as long as you stop short of a full sexual relationship. That touching and petting and so on is somehow acceptable. Well, apparently there were some pretty clear limits here of something that it would be okay for Isaac and Rebecca to do in a public place, but it would not be okay for two single people to do. So think about that in the way, the rules that you establish, the limits you establish in a dating relationship, what you will permit a young man to do with you or a young lady to do with you. Let's keep some limits there. My wife and I work with kids in a camp setting, and we established some basic rules on that. And one of the rules is that there was to be no contact between unmarried people. No contact that would suggest any kind of a dating or a romantic relationship. It's okay to shake hands or give the typical greeting hug, but nothing that would suggest any kind of a dating relationship between those, between unmarrieds. Now, in that same context, if I want to kiss my wife, I'll kiss my wife. I'm not going to make a big scene of it, but there's nothing wrong with me showing affection to her, an affection that is appropriate for married people, but still something decent that might happen in public. That's basically what Isaac was doing here. So we need to remember that there are some limits on what we can allow ourselves to be involved in while single. Getting to the New Testament. Sex continues to be treated seriously. Jesus reaffirmed the principle of Genesis 2. A man leaves his father and wife, father and mother is joined to his wife. The two become one flesh. He said that illicit sexual relations are the only motive that allows for divorce and remarriage. Matthew chapter 19, verse 9. Paul, in his teaching, treats sexual immorality as a sin against the body which belongs to Christ. And I want us to look now at some things here in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. It's an interesting argument that Paul makes in this text. If you back up to verse 12, 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting at verse 12. He says, all things are lawful for me, but all things are not helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be brought under the power of any. He'll use that same expression in chapter 10. People don't think Paul uses irony in his writing. In both texts, he's talking about things that are absolutely not lawful. But they may have come along and somehow tried to use this argument. Paul said, well, fornication is not lawful. Chapter 10, idolatry is not lawful. But you guys think it's all okay. Well, hang on here for a minute. Then he uses another argument that probably they were using. Verse 13, foods for the stomach and the stomach for foods. It's just a desire of my body. I'm just satisfying a desire of my body, just like I eat. And if they were using that to describe the sexual relationship, just satisfying a natural appetite, nothing more, he says, but God will destroy both it and them. What? The stomach and the foods. Newsflash, we're not going to be eating in heaven. We're not going to have food or stomachs there. Those things go. That's not part of our eternal existence. But he goes on to say, continuing that same verse, now the body is not for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God both raised up the Lord and will also raise us up by his power. So the body belongs to God. The body will continue to exist. It'll be transformed into an eternal state. It's not going to have a stomach. We're not going to be given in marriage, but the body that God has taken for himself will continue to exist. And so we need to protect it. We need to care for it. And the point here is caring for it in this sense of purity. Verse 15, do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a harlot? Certainly not. There's a coming together, almost a fellowship kind of idea in this relationship, not to be done with a harlot. Do you not know that he who is joined to a harlot is one body with her? For the two, he says, shall become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord is one spirit with him. What is the primary argument that Paul is making here about sexual immorality? Don't allow your body to be used for sexual immorality because it is not yours. It belongs to God. So keep it pure for him. Now, when you get married and have a relationship with your wife, you're not dirtying up your body. You're not defiling your body. You're still keeping it pure for him. But any other kind of relationship, any illicit relationship, is defiling that purity. The body belongs to God. It will be raised and therefore should be protected. Okay. some implications and applications of this. We're going to work on wrapping down in the next several minutes here. If there's any time left at the end, I'll open it up for questions, but I'm not sure we're going to have that. When we devalue sex, we're the losers. When we take it down from that position that God gave it and allow it to be treated as something insignificant, common, instead of something so special, we are in that becoming the losers. When we accept the world's cheapened concept of sex, it is just an activity for entertainment. My wife sometimes comments that it seems like in many contexts that people, young people especially, view sex almost like it was just a sporting activity. Okay, we got some time free today. You want to play volleyball or have sex? That's the kind of cheapened attitude that much of our society has presented to that. We can't buy into that. Devaluing of sex threatens marriages, families, our own holiness, and threatens our salvation. That's what Paul's saying to us in 1 Corinthians chapter 6. This is serious business. But if we look at sex from a scriptural perspective, look at what we gain with that. Look at how we appreciate the beauty of something fantastic that God has given to us. First of all, it involves a victory over our own selfish attitudes. And this particular point, I'm going to have to confess, it took me a few years after I got married to start to really come around to appreciating this. And I suspect that's true for an awful lot of men. Maybe for women too. But I think many of us, when we are young men, getting ready for marriage, and even entering into that marriage relationship, it's, well, now I have a way that is acceptable, that God approves, that's a good thing, to be able to deal with these sexual desires that I have been fighting to control throughout my life. And so now I'm going to get something good out of this. That's kind of selfish, isn't it? We're going into marriage with a selfish perspective on that. What we're supposed to learn is that I'm going to give something good in this. That the primary relationship or purpose of that relationship is not for self, it's for partner. That's the approach that Paul takes in 1 Corinthians 7 when he says that we don't have authority over our own body that the spouse has and that we are therefore providing for the benefit of the spouse. So we need to see that as something that is giving and loving, and in that way it is truly, even the expression, the idea of making love, it's the idea of truly giving us something that is loving. I often make the point in teaching, dealing especially with young people, it is impossible for single people to make love. Impossible. Can't be done. Single people might have sex, but they cannot make love because it is not a loving act if you are contributing to somebody's eternal damnation by what you're doing. They're having sexual relations. They're not making love. Married people can make love. Married people can have a relationship that involves a giving because of love for the other person. It gives us an appreciation for God's wisdom. He's offered the couple something so special, so unique, so exclusive, that it becomes a sort of a glue in the marriage relationship, helping to keep them together. We have a motivation to be faithful in marriage and not to profane what God has given us. And in that, benefits can be felt generations down. 3 minutes? Okay, I'm going to talk fast and you all are not going to get to ask questions. It's kind of easier for me that way, but... One other thing, about the only way God seems to have found in the Bible to find something comparable to this special relationship of husband and wife, is to talk about His love for His people, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And you think about that, He's given you something in your marriage relationship that, but the only other way to describe it is to talk about God's love for His people, Christ and His love for the church. Now, wrapping up here, I want to ask you to think about some things. And I want to suggest a few things that maybe, I fear that the difficulty we have in these questions is really a symptom of a broader problem that we may have in our attitudes about holiness. So I want you to kind of fill in the blank there. How many years have you been a Christian? After 5 years, 10 years, 30 years of conversion, do we as men know how to love our wives as Christ loved the church? You know, that's what a lot of this is about. It's about loving our wives. And I'm not talking just about the sexual relationship. I'm talking about all aspects of our role as husbands. Have we learned to love our wives? Do women know how to be submissive to their husbands as the church should be submissive to Christ? You've been a Christian for 10, 15, 20 years. Have you learned to obey your husband like God said to? Are you showing that kind of submission to him? Have we repudiated and learned to hate the works of the flesh that destroy souls? I'm afraid in some of this stuff, we kind of flirt with this, like, you know, I would if I could, but I can't, so if I could. Isn't that sometimes almost the way we look at some of these things? Do we show decency and modesty in our clothing? You know, sometimes I see Christians continuing to try to defend that we can use all the fashions that the world uses, use all the sensual clothing that the world uses. What about our holiness? What about the change that we've made? Do we turn away from sensual temptations? The other side of the coin. We don't have the right to go along looking and lingering with that desire for somebody who is not our own spouse. Do we find adultery, homosexuality, other forms of fornication repugnant? Or do we somehow try to defend those things or even to fuel our own fantasies of things that God has prohibited? We need to be holy not just in outward actions. The Pharisees got that part. Don't commit adultery. We need to be holy in our thoughts. And if we will do that, we will see sex as something beautiful, pure, wonderful that God has given us. Because he has called us to be holy as he is holy. Time's up. Thank you all very much. If you have questions afterwards, seek out any of the elders of the congregation here. And they'll help you out. Where does this go?
I just said that already.
Okay.